Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today we're going to be talking about cider, American cider, you know, hard cider made from apples. It continues to surprise me. It's just the variations from sweet to dry, the tastes. It's really come into its own. I mean, it's having a bit of a, what we can say, a revival. And it really is delicious. Much as I didn't really think I was going to like ciders so much, I have come to really appreciate them, really appreciate the nuances and how refreshing they are. And, you know, they've got a little bit of alcohol, not too heavy, and that makes it nice too. And not only are they delicious, but they are historic. It's America's first popular alcoholic beverage. And it was made originally from apples brought over the Atlantic from England in the colonial days. And my guest today, cider specialist and sommelier Dan Pucci, and food journalist and cider specialist Craig Cavallo, have really done a deep dive into cider, its history, the nuances, the territories, the terroirs, and the regions where cider is important to the agriculture. So I welcome them today. Welcome, guys.
Thanks so much.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Linda.
Your book, you know, has been called a well-researched roadmap. And that in terms of, you know, the metaphor roadmap, but also you do point out all the interesting areas and regions where cider is being produced, and is a lot of changes are coming about in that. And but first, what I want to talk about are the changes. I mean, to what do you attribute all this modern interest and revival of cider making? It seems like every time I turn around, there's another little cider bar and cider, you know, center popping up. What do you think? What brought that about?
I'll start there. Thanks for having us again. So this is Dan. We're talking about what kind of started cider today. It's kind of a combination of a few things. So A, there's a lot of downward pressure in the cider in the commercial apple world. Apple farmers have had probably one of the hardest times. Farming is hard, and apple farmers have had it the worst. One of my best examples of this is that in the book we talk about Steve Wood, who's a founding cider maker at Poverty Lane Orchards in Farnham Hill in Vermont, in New Hampshire. He, in the 1970s, he was getting around $40 a bushel for tiny 2-inch Macintoshes that he would export to the UK. Today, the price for apples is around, for like high quality apples here in the Hudson Valley, it's about $40 a bushel. So the price basically has stayed exactly the same for 50 years. Which is crazy, not just to inflation or anything like that. So the value of the product has declined a lot. So because of that, we've seen orchards around the country look to find new ways to innovate. And in the past, innovation came in the place of trying to be more efficient with your fruit, trying to grow more of it for less money, trying to grow more of it on less land. But at certain points, people were competing against themselves and dropping prices farther and further and further. So in the 80s and 90s, in the last 10 years, we've seen orchardists around the country really looking to cider as a way to create more value and create sustainable businesses for orchards around the country. and really create a really excellent and exciting value-added product to use for their fruit. At the same time, we've seen a large rise of small estate cideries that are looking and finding how to grow fruit and grow a farm on a small scale, which needs to include some kind of value-added product. Or we have people who are just simply curious about cider and exploring the potential of this amazing beverage and putting in trees and exploring and researching and diving down the rabbit hole. I think cider is really exciting because of that rabbit hole. I dragged Craig down this rabbit hole a number of years ago, and he can speak to how deep that hole goes because he now owns a restaurant called the Golden Russet Cafe. So, which was definitely not the concept when he started planning that thing.
Well, Craig, maybe you can tell, talk to about why Dan is laughing at the Golden Russet. What does the Golden Russet mean to you? I mean, the type of apple, but yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think, so Dan, short history of why I sort of am on the chat here with Dan and Linda with you. Dan asked me, as a writer, many things that I've done over the years. I was a writer for a while. And so when Dan was framing this book in the context and the narrative, he asked me to help him. And as a dear friend, of which Dan and I have been for many years, I said yes. And just in starting to do the research, I was really just astounded with how deeply intertwined apples in that history are in this country, specifically in our case of the book, but just kind of the greater, you know, human species. They're inseparable, and they're just so entwined and entangled. And then the development of this country in tandem with that sort of entanglement just really, it really hit home and got somewhere deep in my soul, and just is kind of a part of, you know, my life's work, you might say. And so, yeah, just it's actually my wife Jenny, her idea for to name the cafe Golden Russet, but she's also kind of one of the you know, the freelance editor, so to speak, of the book, and was kind of reading all of it. But
do you have any Golden Russet trees producing apples on the property?
Not here, no, not yet. I put in seven trees 2020, last spring, but it'll be some time before they fruit. But one of them is, it's a Golden Russet, and it's growing like a weed.
You didn't used to see Golden Russets, except if you had a property. I have a couple of like really ancient ones on my property. Must be well over 150 years old, the trees
Amazing.
Themselves. And they still produce a few Golden Russets every now and then. Not pretty, and I'm not doing anything to help them along, not pruning them. But they make really nice applesauce, and they make really nice cider. So, lucky me, right?
There's an old anecdote from like mid-19th century from an apple grower in Ohio who was looking for advice, and the advice was, if you're going to plant 1,000 trees, make 999 of them Golden Russet, and the rest you can choose for yourself, is sort of how the advice goes. But yeah, they're versatile. They're great. They fell from favor as red and green apples were coming online and, you know, grafting in commercial orchards and markets and blah, blah, blah. And Golden Russet, as we know, is not the most beautiful fruit. It is in its own ways. But yeah, the market kind of took to the shinier, brighter red and green orbs. But anyway, that's the Golden Russet aside.
Well, why don't we back up a little bit and talk about cider and the history of cider. You put in a nice little history portion in there in the book, and that's what really attracted me to it, to see this, you know, ancient history come up in the book. So talk a little bit about that and how far we've come. Dan, can you talk to that?
So apples originate in Central Asia. If Mesopotamia is the Middle East is the breadbasket of the world, then Central Asia is basically the orchard of the world. Not only are apples native there, but most cane fruits, blackberries, cherries, pistachios, almonds, all these things kind of originate in Central Asia. And then, you know, over the millennia, they've spread since then. And they've spread throughout Asia, into the Middle East, and throughout Europe. And then from Europe, they moved into North America and South America, with the advent of colonialization. When apples first came here, Europeans were shocked at how well they performed. And at the same time, Europeans kind of created a perfect environment for apples. They basically deforested the landscape. So apple seeds were able to come up behind it pretty seamlessly, which is why we have all these amazing wild apples that thrive throughout the Northeast United States, which is really unique and not something that's the case in a lot of the rest of the country. So at that point in time, we have this cider becomes a part of the American diet. Craig, what, around the early 1700s or so, you'd say? You want to talk about this part of this part, Craig?
Sure. Yeah. Europeans, as they're coming here, they're bringing a relic, something from home. You know, this voyage overseas it's unknown. They don't know where they're going to land or what to expect. They bring apple seeds. They're small. They're, you know, nearly weightless. They're durable. They get here, they plant them, and the ones that are strong enough grow. And it's important to note that apples don't grow true from seed. So any seed planted that grows and produces fruit is going to be a variety unknown to humankind. So to Dan's point about the Northeast being a great climate and region for apple growing, that happened. And the apples that tasted good were, you know, they were eaten fresh or baked or, you know, eaten in some way that kind of sustained the family, the small orchard. But those that were bad were likely just found their way to the press, and they were fermented for cider. And it was just so commonplace that it wasn't, you know, it was hardly talked about. It was just the thing. Every, you know, farmer and their family had a barrel in the basement, or, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 or 40, depending on the scope and the wealth. But, cider was just very, very common. And yeah, around probably, yeah, early 18th century, as people kind of figured out how to navigate the new world, so to speak, the orchards were, you know, producing, and apples were there. And kind of at the advent of a market system in the Northeast, apples started to kind of move from place to place. And that's when we start to get into specific named varieties. But
to add something to Craig there too. So cider is peaking in North America is around the time of when farms were still largely self-sufficient entities, when they were mostly producing subsistence crops. It was a product that would be, you could produce and maybe have access to sell at market, but apple trees grow well on sparse land, that on hillsides where you could still graze cattle there, but also like you couldn't grow row crops. You definitely couldn't grow field crops there either. So you can grow apples there, no problem. And you have apples, and you have all the apples, which would be easy to produce into as part of your diversified farm. And then, as Craig's point, there is some market engagement in terms of people then selling apples or selling cider into cities and things like that. But the downfall of cider in this country comes about when we have a professionalization of orcharding and the rise of orchards. Commercial orchards here in this country kind of plays in line with the decline of cider in this country. The first commercial orchard is Robert Livingston Pell, whose orchards in Esopus, New York, on the west side of the Hudson, is the first like commercial orchard. And that's 1821-ish, right, Craig, more or less?
Early 19th century, 1830s maybe.
And he made a business of basically exporting Newtown pippins from there around the world, especially to the UK. And he made a good deal of money doing that. And if you're and then his business model was exported up and down the Hudson Valley, and then soonly across the country. And if you're selling fruit for fresh value and it's being shipped as a whole fruit to the UK and be eaten there, you're getting way more money for those apples than you ever would for pressing in the cider and making something that your neighbors would drink. So with that, the emphasis for orcharding moved into those kinds of apples and away from apples that would be useful for making cider with.
So then what you're saying is there was no interest in commercial cider making. Everyone was producing their own cider for their own consumption?
Yeah, there are limited pockets of like commercial cider making. like the big one in the East Coast is Newark, New Jersey is the apple. It made champagne method, traditional method, sparkling cider from four varieties there that are very famous. They're relatively famous varieties. Craig, you want to add something to that?
Yeah. So around this time, like 1830s, there's also what was happening on, you know, industrialization was sort of nearing its peak in tandem with development of urban centers. And so you had people becoming much more efficient at producing goods and products. And so you had this sort of the idea of commodity production, of which orchards took that path. And we started to see grafted orchards of, you know, maybe three or four varieties meant intended to be eaten fresh. So that's partly because cider was falling from common custom. And with the rise of industrialization, you had a centralized workforce and mill towns and just developing urban areas. And in order to control these workforces, the employer was kind of, you know, echoing temperance, which was really ramped up in the 1820s, just the demonization of alcohol. So if you want a reliable workforce, don't drink. And cider, of course, being alcoholic, was one of the many beverages, and you know, that fell kind of into the shadow, so to speak, from a common cultural custom. So people are drinking less, and orchards are being planted for fresh eating, and those two kind of things just created a rift that you could argue until now was not really being like sewn back together.
And if you are gonna produce alcohol in as the country urbanized, if you're going to make alcohol and serve alcohol in the new country, in the new urban economy, like beer is so much easier to produce. Like the bringing apples, you can just produce it on site, quick turnover. It's much more straightforward to produce than trying to make cider in an urban environment.
Oh, and the rum trade must have driven.
Right. There's so much easier things. There's so much easier things to do than make cider. Unless you're getting a price point for it. But at that point in time, there was no high value cider really. It was mostly people drank it because it was there kind of thing.
So let's talk about the temperance and then, you know, a few years later, the, prohibition. I mean, initially they made exception for cider and orchards.
Early temperance writing is basically mostly focused on hard spirits. It's definitely focused on rum and other distilled spirits, and basically ignores. There's a lot of like amazing. I think one of the best writing quotes, best quotes I found from that time period, talks about it was a like New York Pomological Association from the 1830s, let's say, about that time period. And it's talking about how we can get people to drink cider. And so we need to change the name from cider to malice wine, which is like a hilarious idea. And people still try and revisit every few years or so now. not recently, but about 5 years ago, people were trying, we need to make a new name for cider. It was a pretty funny idea for us to think about, entertain. But, one of the guys says, like, I went to Spain, and like in countries where people drink wine, there is no drunkenness, which is like, I think, a hilarious idea of him, like, of this correlation between like wine and sobriety, which is a pretty funny, pretty funny thing. So by this time, so temperance comes in effect and cider is excluded, but then later temperance movements, writings in later past century definitely include cider as part of that, as part of the bad things. By the time prohibition actually happens, like there is often an analogy of people, there's often a story told in terms of cider where people like were out chopping down in cider orchards, but and to destroy these orchards because they were making cider, but it never actually happened because there were no orchards to destroy. Like as you just said, there was no one was there were probably a handful of orchards growing apples for alcoholic cider in the country by the time prohibition happened. So there was no destruction of them. They just the orchards were never there in the first place to actually destroy. Craig, do you want to add anything to my rants and raving?
No, that's accurate. Just I'll echo frustration in reading about that, and just people, it seems to just be the softball that people accept as reality, that orchards were being chopped down from Prohibition. But to Dan's point, it was sort of nearly 100 years prior, cider was already kind of vanishing from the cultural norm. And we talk about the election of William Henry Harrison in 1840, who he ran on the Log Cabin and Hard Cider campaign, kind of, you know, portraying cider as this like relic bit of nostalgia from the past. And I'm the approachable man, like I'm the everyman. And, you know, I'm a poor farmer, just like all of us once were, and vote for me kind of a thing, using cider kind of ironically already in as early as 1840, 90 years before Prohibition.
No, I was very impressed. Your book, really, just American Cider. I mean, that great name, first of all. It really just gives so much like history and movement along the way. And I particularly was struck by a phrase that you use. And you said that cider embodies the best and worst of America's history and agricultural practices. Now, I can think of a couple of things to ascribe to that, but you want to talk about that phrase a little bit, and what you meant by this? I mean, it's certainly not, again, certainly not a metaphor, but it is, you're really talking about what it did to, you know.
I'll talk about Craig, I'll talk about the worst and you can talk about the best. How about that?
Sure.
I have the easy part now. So the worst of it is that basically, like, well, cider is a colonialist intervention to North America, where it's definitely an intrusive thing that came in and destroyed a lot of other stuff. And apple trees, you know, replaced a lot of things that were here beforehand. And our contemporary apple movement today is a reaction largely to the errors of the last 50 or 100 years or so, where I was saying earlier, where we basically have destroyed apple farming in this country, where we've driven it to a point where prices are really low, almost artificially low, and that cider is a reaction against those really artificially low prices. Like part of the reason why is that in the late 80s, mass amounts of orchards in northern China came online and basically tanked the commodity, like really bulk commercial apple product market. I mean, like concentrated apple juices and things like that really just destroyed the market. And it basically has never recovered since, not only for the Chinese orchards, but other orchards in Poland and in Turkey and places like that, that basically have that orchards that were here can't compete with that, which is why we saw in the 80s orchards pivoting to U-picks or things like that, or just going out of business. And cider is a, like, It has a lot of problems in terms of finding its path, and it creates a certain amount of elitism to it, and people trying to leading these kind of wine connotations to it. But at the same time, it's a really hopeful beverage that we can try and do something different with it.
So the best of the agricultural practices in history, Craig.
It's sort of it's hard to talk about the best without talking about the worst and acknowledging it and kind of, like Dan was saying, learning from it and moving forward. But, you know, a lot of the information we found was kind of, it's important to just kind of lay the fact that the domineering culture in this country is one of white Europeans. And so that was kind of a lot of the historic information documentation we came across was that, because it supports the dominant culture. But it ignores the contributions from folks who were not white Europeans, but were also very knowledgeable in some instances, more than the aristocratic elite that we hear about often, who were cider connoisseurs and blah, 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 when it was, you know, in some cases, their slaves or just other communities doing the work of providing the knowledge. But the great part about cider then and now is that regardless of how much information there's about one fact or the other, it was a very inclusive beverage and pursuit and growing trees, and everybody did it. Everyone had an orchard. It was not really exclusionary, and it's kind of, you know, it shows, I think it, John Bunker, if I'm not mistaken, calls the apple the great bipartisan fruit. And in a way, it's sort of, it's something that we can all relate to. And it just really you know, it's a unifying fruit at the end of the day. It really is. And I think that's the greatness of apples and cider.
And to add to that, we, in moving today, like these small scale orchards that are popping out of the country now, we didn't mention this earlier, but the growth of cider has been crazy. Like 100 years ago, in 20 years ago, there were 10 cideries in the United States. There were 100 a decade ago. Now there's close to 1,000 today.
Wow.
Which is a crazy growth. And some of that growth is coming from these existing orchards, and it's also happening from these new small orchards that are coming online. And these new small orchards are redefining what it means to make and operate small farm, what small scale farming can look like in this country, which involves creating a really great product, and to growing this really great fruit is to create a really well-valued, value-added product to it. I think there's a lot of amazing parallels in the apple world, in the milk world, in the cheese world, because the milk industry is also pretty hard and bad prices and broken industry, and cheese became a way for small farms to stay competitive and actually like make a business that actually can exist and survive, and cider is giving that route for people, and it's doing it in a way that is creates like really good land stewardship programs. So there's some like talking with folks at Finger Lake Cider House, which is cutting string cider. They basically took a sterile dead cornfield and converted it into this amazing biodiverse landscape through tree fruit. And it's a really amazing way to restore the landscape in a really unique way and create better land stewardship, which is going to be really important in the next decades to come. And how we can do that. But in places like California, with water issues, like it's really sad seeing all these new. There was a big controversy this summer about like very vocal people about climate change in California tearing out old trees and putting in like grapevines in Sonoma County, which require a lot more water, require a lot more inputs than like 100-year-old apple trees do that are still productive. Like and understanding that. Like what the cider looks like in the future from that, in that perspective is very interesting and very important.
An interesting thing, just looking at like land stewardship, we saw a lot of history that was exploitive both of people and of land. But if you look at the Dust Bowl, how much further proof do you need of, you know, taking too much without any sort of cautionary hesitance, you know, and just kind of look at the outcome. So, understanding apples and, you know, to Dan's point about the Sonoma County situation, just they really, and that's why they were planted to begin with, because you planted them once, you didn't need a seasonal sowing. They were fairly, you could neglect them and they would thrive in some instances, most instances, and you just harvest them once a year. And that's kind of the contribution. You don't need to spray, you don't need to water. And so, yeah, from a viability standpoint, it's much more economical and you know, good for the land in the long run, which is things that we need to consider.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the actual physical product itself, cider, and how it's made and how it tastes and what you can tell me about that. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Okay. I'm back, and I'm speaking with Dan Pucci and Craig Cavallo. They are the authors of a very recently published book called American Cider, A Modern Guide to a Historic Beverage. And we talked early in the show about, you know, the history of cider, of apples, of and not a whole lot about cider making. But now cider making is this huge industry. As Dan, you said, there were more than how many thousand?
It's 1,000 in the country.
About 1,000 cideries.
In every state.
Wow. How would you compare the cider of the colonial days? Not that you have any to taste, but from what you know and what you've, you know, heard and read, compared to what's being produced today? Or let's even say not that far back. You could even say, you know, cider of the 1960s and 70s and what we have today.
Cider back then was pretty rough, it seems like. I think there's a article about this guy Trowbridge, who's a like writes in the probably is after Columbia, probably 1880s or so. It basically says like it's a book you wrote about cider making and talks all about how like it's all terrible, like everything you guys make is the worst. Like it's like 80% of the cider produced in the country is god awful and undrinkable. And there is some good descriptions out there of products, more in the UK than here in this country. But it is usually considered like a golden liquid. It's very pretty. Even in that time period, like William Cox, who is this, wrote this book in 1805 or so, talks a lot about, like his varieties that he uses, which is like, he likes it's Winesap, Hughes, and I forget the other variety he uses. It's Winesap, Hughes, and one other variety. And he like talks a lot about it. And russets are referred to quite a bit as well. And Newtown Pippin, I talked about earlier, also. So we know the varieties that are being used back then. And we can generally make assumptions on how it would end up tasting, which would be probably fairly similar to some people's cider today, but not all cider making today. We understand how yeast works, for example, so we have a better understanding of how things operate. But I think we've changed a lot in the last 50 years too. Like Martinelli's wasn't making hard cider until the 1970s.
Huh.
But in terms of I think we've improved a lot, and I think part of the fun about cider is that we're always improving. Like in the last 10 years, we've improved a lot in quality. In the last five years, have gone huge growth in terms of the quality of cider being produced today in the country. So I think there's gonna be a lot more of that, and we're gonna keep on an upward path of really increased quality.
Well, you say we know a lot more about yeast and things. Is that the major shift? What would you say would be, either one of you, the major shift or change in how cider is produced today?
I think probably comes down to the science of it, just the understanding of yeast and a fermentation, but also I think cleanliness is probably a huge factor in having more successful ferments today than were happening 100 or 150 years ago. But I think those two things definitely, in the vessels, the way in which people are doing it. I mean, historically people have been using barrels, oak barrels, wood barrels, but different vessels and just different ways of crushing the fruit and pressing the fruit, and just kind of the consistent cleanliness through the whole process is making a much more compelling and sound in dynamic beverage. Most likely, of course, I wasn't around back then, but I imagine the cleanliness is just, you know, it wasn't something that, you know, people are doing it to make a living now. And I think that changes the way you go about doing things.
Sure. I mean, yeah, what about regulations? Were there more stringent regulation today? And I mean, if you're going to sell it on the market, you know.
Yeah, I think my favorite regulation thing about that was that it really wasn't regulated for a large part of the history. It wasn't really taxed very well, and that was again one of the things too, because if you're making it at home, it wasn't necessarily taxed. It was part of a pretty informal economy, definitely not really regulated. And actually, one of a lot of problems we have with cider today is that basically when they wrote all the alcohol laws post prohibition, cider didn't get included in a lot of those alcohol laws. So in the last, as cider has risen in popularity, cider has been shoehorned into existing legislation into existing laws. So it kind of fall. You can be a cidery and be regulated by four different agencies. And your packaging is very different, and we can't list things like, for example, like the Finger Lakes is a AVA. We can't list the word Finger Lakes on a bottle of cider because it's a AVAs are restricted to grape wine beverages. And if you make anything that's not grape wine, you can't list it on the label. So we can't list Finger Lakes. Hudson Valley was fine for a very long time, although people were getting dinged for it recently because the AVA is called the Hudson River Valley Region. And we were getting somewhat dinged sometimes in the Hudson Valley. So it's been this huge issue where we weren't regulated properly then, and now we're playing catch up in a lot of capacities.
Well, you talk a lot in your book about the language of cider. So that brings me to thinking about about the taste of cider. And obviously, it's changed a lot more today, a little more refined. I was surprised to taste cider you could have told me it was cider. Number one, it wasn't effervescent, really, or not hardly effervescent. And it was crisp and dry as a bone. And, you know, I did sense that it wasn't a grape wine. So I pegged it as a cider then. But for the novice, what should one expect when they taste cider?
I think a lot of what you just said, it's crisp, it's bright, generally high acid, it's very refreshing. One of the things that makes it so fun to drink is that it's a lower ABV. Generally around here in New York and the Northeast, cider tends to be around 7% or so. But it also, that lower ABV allows a lot of the phenolics that exist in apples to just really come through. Higher alcohol, 13, 14, 15%. Can sometimes mask impurities, but is this, you know, lower ABV, there's really a chance to kind of like taste the fruit. And I think that's part of the reason it's so fun to drink cider. But it depends. It depends on how it's made. It depends on how it's aged, if not, or if it ferments in oak or steel. You know, there's a lot of different things you can taste, but I think generally speaking, a well-made cider, you're going to find a great balance of same things you find a balance of in wine, and that's acid and tannin and, you know, sweetness, sugar. Cider's mostly being fermented to dry. That's probably a larger part of the category, rather than some cider having residual sugar, which gives you a perceived sweetness, so fruit forward. But I think just generally speaking, kind of if it's sparkling, it's light, it's bright, it's punchy, it's delicious and super refreshing.
But more importantly, let's be open about the experience, because there's a huge range of flavors that exist here. We have kind of big, brooding, rich, caramelized, golden russet flavors that are like apricots and peaches and stewed and lanolin, versus like wixen, which is like rose petals and bright and acid and punchy. Or we have like some like rough and tumbled scrumpy, which is, you know, a little acidic and a little funky and earthy and herby and all those jazz. There's a huge range of flavors of apples, and we can find this in this cider too.
Huh, interesting. The question I had was, how long, generally speaking, or does it range like winemaking, how long does cider have to lay down before it can be bottled?
It depends. You can make... like if you go to the grocery store and buy a 6-pack of cider and cans, those ciders are probably can be packaged on the shelf in less than 3 weeks from apple to apple product to whatever it is. But you know, most cider we're talking about in the book mostly deals with things that would be packaged in 750 or 750 like vessels or things or intentions at that price point. And those can take up to a year, 18 months, 2 years. No problem. Like if we have fermentation that takes 6 months or so and then goes in the bottle and goes champagne method, like our friends Matt and Kim, who are over in Esopus, whose orchard they have Metal House cider, and their orchards are on the old orchards where the Pell orchards were. They do all their champagne method ciders. And Craig, you bought them the other day, and they're all at least 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah, they have things that are from 2017 And that's like incredibly unheard of, yeah, for cider.
And, but it's delicious and not. So Eric does it too. A Redbird. There's lots of amazing cider that like that is on the market that's that old, and it takes that time to really mature and kind of come together and show off some of its real potential.
Has the market kind of kept up with, let's say, the you know, the quality of that and willingness to spend the extra dollars for that product?
I think now it has. It was hard a couple years ago. It was definitely more challenging. But I think the quality of the product has increased a lot. But Craig sells more cider than I do these days. Yeah. So he can speak to that. But I think people are totally willing. I think as beer prices have increased dramatically and people have been totally willing to spend more on beer than were a few years ago, like it's been totally fine spending on it. Craig, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's climbing and it's a slow climb. And as a cider maker, I would think in some instances you want that climb to happen a little more quickly. But it's a slow climb. I still, generally speaking, like we don't have any cider at the store that's a more than like 26 might be the highest. And to me, understanding what goes into it, maybe more than the average consumer, I think it's absurd that people aren't paying like $40 or $45 for these ciders Matt and Kim make because it's champagne. It just isn't champagne, so nobody's willing to pay $65 because it's from apples and it's not that comfort of, you know, you spend $65 on a bottle of champagne if you're of able means, and it's like you don't feel bad about it. There's no buyer's remorse because it's like, yeah, it's champagne. It's a thing. It's like ingrained in all of us. But cider is $35. You know, it's just not quite there, but hopefully it's on the up and up for many reasons.
Right. Well, so that was one of my questions for you is that's what are your predictions for cider's future?
I think that's part of it. I think the price point will you know, continue to increase in some instances, but that's certainly not the most important part of cider. I think we're just going to continue to see really dynamic beverages and people learning more in the cellar and seeing that reflected in the final product. But we're also, you know, people every year are putting in new orchards. And so new fruit's going to be coming online and that's going to affect what's in the bottle. But I think the future of cider is truly limitless. You know, it's not a category that you can put boxes around. There's just so many apple varieties. There's so much to learn. There's so many different ways you can go about making it. And that coupled with just people getting better at the craft cider's just going to continue to be an incredibly dynamic category.
Yeah. And there's 14,000 varieties of apples that have been documented to be grown in North America. And like there's always, and the season is more and more on command line every day, every year. I had one today, Craig. I was over at Rose Hill earlier today by my house, the orchard by my house. And I had, Kevin gave me, orchard manager gave me, he had 15 of the apples from this year. They have 10 trees of a variety called Nail Biter. It's a variety from this guy, Matt Kaminsky, who's a forager apple dude in Western Mass, cultivated. He selected this variety from a wild cutting he found, and he introduced it, and it's growing here on trees by my house. And one of the most intensely delicious cider apples I've ever had. It was so tannic. You ate it, you bit into the apple, and it was like, oh my God, tannin. I'm like, oh my God, there's so much sugar here. This apple is so sweet, and oh my God, it's so tart. Then oh my God, it's so tannic. It was this big apple too. It was a crazy thing. It was a real. It almost looked like the coloration was different, but it had the shape of like a golden, like a red delicious. It was a totally weird apple because of how intense it was. But that's the feature, and that's what's so exciting about cider is that like we can have this conversation. It's really unique and. There's thousands of these experiments happening around the country.
It just makes it super fun. There's no boundaries people are trying to weasel their way into. So people are willing to take chances, and often cases, you know, those chances are gonna pay off. Or if they don't, you learn from it and move on. But the fact that the cider community is willing to take chances makes it it's awesome.
It's exciting.
It's really exciting.
One thing that I wanted to tell our listeners about your book is that aside from all this wonderful information that you've, you know, so willingly shared with me today, you mention and you talk a lot about all the different regions in the United States, which was surprising to me, some of the regions, where apples are growing, where cider is being made. And I guess I was just surprised. I didn't think that apples really grew in some of those places, Arizona, for instance. What do you think are some of the most surprising regions that people might not think apples are part of their agriculture?
Well, in the research, I think in early like 1900s, the two most northern counties in Arkansas were the leading producing counties of apples. And that has since changed, of course. But that was obviously, you know, Arkansas, you don't think that far south. But to your point about Arizona, the mountains, you know, there's apples growing at 10, 12, 15,000 feet. And that's crazy to read about and learn about. But I think one of the most compelling places today that's standing on the past and really pushing, you know, apples of yesterday into tomorrow is Montezuma County in southwest Colorado. It's kind of just this, like, it's a mountain town. Well, mountain town, it's a valley, and it's like 6 hours from any major metropolis. So historically, there was no real growing for market because you couldn't get there over the mountains. It was just very, like, localized. But there's still tons of really old trees, and people are making some really great cider down in the valley in the mountains of southwest Colorado. And that was cool to learn about.
The reason I wanted to mention that too is because it's for anyone who wants to take a tour of apples and vineyards. I mean, this book serves as a real guide. I mean, not only is it, you know, a roadmap to the culture and the background and the history, but it's a literal roadmap to where all these orchards are and where they exist. And I find that fascinating, and I look forward to all kinds of wonderful things to come in the cider industry, and you guys will certainly help that. Now, tell me, Craig, you are producing cider in where?
Well, I don't make it.
Not commercially.
Okay. I make it for friends and family and out of curiosity, but
just like the colonists.
I run a cafe. I run a grocery store with my wife, Golden Russet Cafe and Grocery, and in the Hudson Valley. I'm near Dan. He's about 20 minutes north of me in the town north. But yeah, that's been my main pursuit for July 2019. We opened the store, and it's going well, and we're you know, learning a bunch, but cider's become a huge part of it, and we're finding it's working really well. People are happy to engage in the conversation. I think the book helps is sort of, you know, I'm not just some babbling idiot in an apron. maybe suggests I know a thing or two, which I might, but again, to, you know, we're all still learning, so there's no finite information here, but yeah, that's grocery store.
Oh, congratulations.
Cafe and groceries.
And Dan, well, are you making cider?
No, I am. No.
Just drinking.
drinking just all
drinking,
of mine.
Drinking and talking about it.
That's great.
I don't make it. I'm all into the communication and research and the experience of it. And there's so much more to learn and explore with the beverage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, can't do everything, right?
No, can't do everything.
Yeah. Well,
he gets pretty close, though.
I congratulate you both on the book, because it really is for, you know, it's not a huge book, but boy, oh boy, is there a lot packed in there. And your information on that you have, you know, traveled through the stories of apples and orchards and cider is truly wonderful. And thank you so much for sharing with me today.
You bet.
Yeah, our pleasure. Time, thanks so much.
Great. Okay.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you all for listening. And tune in again to another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place.
and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.